you are. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In his 7.5 years in the White House, Theodore Roosevelt really did carry a big stick. He determined the route of the Panama Canal, took on Wall Street's captains of industry, made the U.S. naval fleet a global power, and won the Nobel Peace Prize. This tree hugger was tall timber when it came to asserting America's dominance on the world stage. In this hour, the legacy of Theodore Roosevelt and lessons for George W. Bush one century later. First, an update on the British al-Qaeda detainees being held in Guantanamo Bay. The United Kingdom has raised concerns about the treatment of the prisoners who were flown out of Afghanistan in hoods and shackles. Norman Smith is political correspondent with the BBC in London. I asked him about what we know about the British subjects being held by U.S. forces.
The details at the moment are still a bit scratchy, but the latest figures we have is apparently 3 confirmed British nationals are currently being held. But the details are sketchy because at the moment there's been no access for British officials to go and visit the camp to exactly assess what the position is, to assess whether these people are British nationals and also to establish their identity. At the moment, Downing Street is saying they do not know who these people are and they're not very close to finding out who they are. What they're trying to do at the moment is to reach an agreement with the authorities in the United States to allow British officials to go and visit the base at Guantanamo Bay to talk to these supposed British members of al-Qaeda to establish exactly who they are and whether they are indeed British nationals.
What are the issues that the UK government has raised about the treatment of these prisoners?
The Home Secretary here, Jack Straw, has phoned Colin Powell. He phoned him over the weekend to express his concern about the conditions under which these prisoners are going to be treated. That said, from the government perspective, they are to some extent going through the motions. I don't think there is any real concern within the British government about what's going on. What there is a degree of unease within the ruling Labour Party and also within some civil liberties groups who are concerned about the way the prisoners are being treated. But the view from Downing Street, from the government, is that United States have said they will abide by the Geneva Convention, that these prisoners will receive exercise, they will receive showers, they will receive medical treatment. The Red Cross is going to be allowed in. And it's also being pointed out from Downing Street's perspective that these are very, very dangerous people, and therefore it is quite right for the U.S. authorities to take the sort of precautions they have, in particular on the flights out from Afghanistan. So at a government level, I think the situation is the government feels obliged to make some representations because these are British nationals. But the real pressure is coming from outside government, where there is concern, as I say, from the left of the Labour Party and from civil liberties groups.
What's the texture of that criticism been? What kind of concerns have been raised?
Well, I suppose the bottom line is that people are judged to be innocent until proven guilty. The second thing is that in Britain it is illegal to hood prisoners, as we understand these people have been on the flights out from Afghanistan. And in the background, of course, is the concern over the death penalty. There is no death penalty in Britain. And it is theoretically possible that were trials to be held, you could hypothetically end up in a situation where a British national could be facing the death penalty. Now, that, of course, would raise considerable diplomatic difficulties. But Downing Street is stressing that is way, way down the line. But that is the sort of comments you're getting from civil liberties groups who are concerned also about the conditions in which these people are being held in these open cages. So there is concern about their human rights, as it were. But I must stress from a government point of view, the government is acknowledging these concerns, but I wouldn't expect them to act particularly vociferously on them. Yes, they will get in touch to ask that British officials can go and visit them, but I wouldn't expect Tony Blair to pick up the phone and get very angry with the president.
But it is interesting that because British nationals are involved, these issues have been raised. We have not had reports of governments of other nations whose nationals are now in Guantanamo raising these issues.
No. Well, I think there is obviously a significant Muslim community in Britain. And during the conflict, I think a lot of people were surprised that there were stories which were confirmed of some mosques in Britain effectively becoming almost recruiting places for Islamic fundamentalists. And some young Muslims did make the journey out to Pakistan, out to Afghanistan to join al-Qaeda. And that's led to a lot of questioning here about how the Muslim community is integrated into British society and whether there are some sections of the Muslim community who feel so alienated and distanced from British society they frankly do not feel British.
Is the presumption then that these British nationals taken captive in Afghanistan are Islamic immigrants to the UK rather than native Britons or sort of the counterpart of the American Taliban who was taken prisoner there?
Well, I would presume that they are going to be second, third generation Muslims. The militant Muslims in Britain tend to be youngsters. Now, that perhaps isn't surprising because youngsters tend to take on board harder ideologies than perhaps older people do with, you know, more experience of life. And certainly the initial immigrants to Britain were very keen to integrate, to establish themselves part of the community. But there has been a sense, I think, among some younger Muslims that they've never really been accepted. They feel they live in worse houses. They don't have an opportunity to get decent jobs. And frankly, they don't feel they've been taken on board British society. At the same time, we have had mosques springing up where they've been preaching a very hard-line, fundamental sort of Islam, and that has perhaps provided them with some other sort of identity which they've taken on board, some literally to the extent of actually going out to join up with the Taliban.
UK Foreign Secretary Jack Straw has said that while they are accused of being members of Al-Qaeda, quote, that does not mean for a second that they do not have rights. He's saying that it may not be the Geneva Convention that covers them, but at least customary international law. And I guess this gets back to the point you made about not being hooded and manacled.
Yes, it does. There are fundamental aspects of law involved here as well. But also I think there's the broader point that having engaged in a war against international terrorism, fighting on the side of democracy, there is a feeling that it would be entirely counterproductive if America was to engage in fairly tough, some would say barbaric treatment of these prisoners, because then the argument is, well, you're not actually behaving that much better. Now, that is an argument, that if you're going to fight a war on democracy, then let's play it down the line and give these people their civil liberties and the due process of law. So I suppose that is in the back of the Home Secretary's mind, that there is no point giving any further propaganda, as it were, to Islamic fundamentalists, and you are better, for political reasons, to play this straight down the book and to ensure that all the due legal processes are observed.
Norman Smith is a political correspondent with the BBC. He spoke with me earlier today from London. Theodore Roosevelt rose to power after an anarchist's assassination of President McKinley in 1901. In his first major statement as president, he warned Americans against the threat posed by untrammeled violence. One century later, President George W. Bush is denouncing evildoers and leading America's response to terrorism. What can President Bush learn from Teddy Roosevelt's view of America's role in the world? Is TR a model for GW in these uncertain times? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from New York is Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Edmund Morris, author of the new biography, Theodore Rex. Good evening and welcome, Edmund Morris.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. And with us from Vermont Public Radio Studios is special coverage news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine, Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Edmund Morris, what a timely biography and what a great read. Much enjoyed. There's a lot to talk about with TR, the man and leader, but we want to ask you first to describe in a nutshell, if you would, the times and challenges that Teddy Roosevelt faced. Describe them, and then we want to explore the issues, what light his response to those challenges might shine on the issues facing G.W. Bush today.
Well, there were emergency issues to face, and there were just the issues that he would have expected to face if he'd become president through the normal course of events in 1904, which was certainly his expectation back in 1901. But the extraordinary events that occurred, the assassination of President McKinley, changed the political landscape in such a fashion that his first order of business as the new young president, the youngest we've ever had, by the way, 42 years old, the first order of business was to reassure the American people, just as President Bush has had to recently, that our institutions, which seem to be fragile because they're so permeable, are actually indestructible. We must remember that President McKinley was the third president to be assassinated in less than 40 years. And the trauma that his assassination inflicted upon the American people was great. He was assassinated by a professed anarchist, which represented a foreign-born strain of anarchism brought in from Europe and intimately tied up with unrestricted immigration. Mm-hmm. And the aim of these anarchists was precisely that of Al-Qaeda. It was to make use of our institutions in order to bring down our institutions by terrorism and by stealthy spread beneath the cognizance of the law.
He also came into power at a time when the American global role was in the process of changing gears dramatically and when the relationship between government and great corporate power was a top issue on his agenda.
Yes, it was an extraordinary concatenation of events, both unexpected and expected. You're right, the United States became a world power at the precise turn of the century, largely because of its victory in the Spanish-American War, when European power was at last eliminated from the Western Hemisphere, and also because of the economic fact that we had become the richest country in the world and our goods were flooding the world 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. To such an extent that it was quite obvious that America was going to become an economic superpower as well as a military one. So the young president happened to take power at this precise moment in history.
And now, at a time when we have violence, where we have a shifting global role, not to great power, but maybe to hyperpower, and we also have huge corporate power that's been raised most recently in the Enron scandal, we hear that George W. Bush is carrying your book to Crawford, Texas, to read on his vacation. What can G.W. learn from T.R.?
He has a lot to learn from him in the environmental sphere and perhaps also in the corporate sphere, but that is a matter for the future, I think. Right now, it's fairly obvious that what he identifies with is the fact that T.R. was a young, untried president, and who had to handle an enormous national emergency immediately after becoming president, did so with a combination of forceful action and extremely strong rhetoric, expressed nevertheless in simple terms, and did so successfully that within a matter of weeks after his assumption of power, this so-called young, untried president revealed himself to be an extremely strong president with the large loyalty of the American people behind him and the specter of anarchism, even though it was apparent for the rest of his 7.5 years, quickly dwindled down and was replaced by other more long-term issues, such as that of corporate control.
You write about, and we'll come to it after a break, how Theodore Roosevelt took that popularity and used it to push through a tremendous bill of reforms during his presidency. Jack Beatty, do you imagine that somewhere in the back of George W. Bush's mind, he may be tracking that as well and asking himself, earlier positions notwithstanding, whether he might somehow emerge from this trial a kind of reformer himself?
Well, it would be something. I mean, they would take an ideological shift on the part of the president, and I think I think that would be going some. Also, it must be very daunting for anybody to contemplate the life of Theodore Roosevelt, any other mortal. I've been to Sagamore Hill, and the bookshelves there groan, and the bookshelves there groan under his books, under books he wrote,
right. and let alone read.
Yeah, and you know, there's that famous quip about FD John Kennedy has supposedly said, "There's more genius here than since Thomas in the White House, and since Thomas Jefferson dined alone." Well, my gosh. When Teddy Roosevelt dined alone, there was a power of genius. So it's quite his big stick must be just very intimidating for Mr. Bush as well as inspiring.
It must be, and Edmund Morris, in your very detailed description of that, you must only make it more daunting. We've just in just 10 seconds, Theodore Rex comes from what, the phrase?
Henry James. He visited the White House in January of 1905. And said that the president, Theodore Rex, is distinctly trying to make a court.
A court as in a king's court.
Yes, Theodore the King. Kingley, imperial president.
We're talking this hour with biographer and Pulitzer Prize winner Edmund Morris about his new book, Theodore Rex, The Life of Teddy Roosevelt, and what light it might shine on the presidency of George W. Bush. What can we learn from Teddy Roosevelt today? What can GW learn from TR? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the passion and politics of Theodore Roosevelt.
I wish to see you boys join the progressive body and act in that body and as good citizens in the same way I'd expect any one of you to act in a football game. In other words, don't flinch, don't foul, and hit the line hard.
Don't flinch, don't foul, and hit the line hard. That was then-citizen Teddy Roosevelt speaking in 1913 to the Boys Progressive League in New York City, 4 years after he left the White House. We're talking this hour with Edmund Morris, biographer extraordinaire and author of the new book Theodore Rex. It's the second volume in his intended three-volume treatment of Theodore Roosevelt. The first volume, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, won the Pulitzer Prize and the American Book Award. He also wrote the best-selling book about President Reagan, Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Should George W. Bush pick up Roosevelt's big stick to police the world, to police big business? Join the conversation. Edmund Morris, help us with a comparison of these two presidents, and maybe a place to start is their careers. They were both have reputations as aristocrats in cowboy boots, but their early lives and early careers were quite different.
Oh, yes, I really don't think you can draw many parallels.
Mm-hmm.
I did meet President Bush a few weeks ago, and I was impressed, first of all, by his enormous physical vitality. He's a lot bigger than you would expect him to be, and he gives off this bursting good health. Now,
well, he pumps iron like Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, yes, he's a superb piece of physical equipment, and he pulsates health. There, I think, is a parallel, because the first impression that Theodore Roosevelt made on people was always physical. He had the most extraordinarily pulsating physical vitality.
But you describe him, and many do, as a hyperkinetic, which is not something that we apply to GW.
No, because the hyperkinesis, if there is such a word, was largely mental. T.R. had one of the fastest minds on record, apart from the physical mechanism, which everybody knows about.
Mm-hmm.
There was this truly extraordinary mind. He simply moved and thought and acted faster than any other human being. He read, on average, a book a day while he was president, sometimes three books a day. There are documented cases of him being given a book over dinner and coming down to breakfast the next morning and disgorging large chunks of the book from his photographic memory.
Wow.
He read in four languages, French, Italian, German, and English. He had a huge cerebral equipment, a knowledge of science and paleontology, a knowledge of the environment. So I could go on for half an hour, but all this, this intellectual activity, this vitality, discharged itself as powerfully as his physical vitality did, which is why people did find him so overpowering.
He liked to express it through the kind of vernacular images of the American West, which is something that we also find in our current president.
Yes, you're quite right. T.R. did have the gift of simple speech and Western vernacular. In fact, one of the reasons he had such communion with the American people was his ability to express some great and important ideas in the language of the man in the street or the man in the saddle. President Bush, I think, does this quite naturally because this is the way folks speak in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But T.R. in the White House, communing with people like Henry Adams and Henry James, was quite capable of switching into extremely cerebral and sophisticated speech. So he tailored his speech to his audience.
He came into the White House with a resume that's far longer and more politically deep than George W.'s is.
True. In that sense, he was not untried. He had a series of executive jobs. It was quite obvious from his 22nd year when he was the minority leader in the New York State Assembly that he was going to go on and on to position after position of power, which he indeed proceeded to do. Civil Service Commissioner, Police Commissioner of New York City, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Colonel of the Rough Riders, Governor of New York State. He packed in all these jobs and wrote all these books and fathered all these children before he even became president at the age of 42.
He came into office determined that the United States would join the ranks of the great powers. And here's where my ears at least really perk up. Now we're wrestling with sole superpower status. People talk about the United States as the hyperpower. We look back a century ago, and he was, in a way, the president who pushed through that transformation from America alone in its happy, abundant continent to global power. Is there anything we can learn from that gear shift now looking where we are today? What's the background that it draws for us about how American presidents have historically looked at the assumption of global power?
He was the first American president who did look at the assumption of global power, and I must emphasize that he was also a very cautious man. Mm-hmm. Even though he was conscious that the United States was the up-and-coming future superpower, it was not yet a superpower. Its navy, for example, was only fifth in the world when he became president. He raised it to the second position before mm-hmm. he left. Mm-hmm. Our army was vestigial. And the major strength that the United States had at the turn of the century was economic. But he had to conduct himself as the leader of this new country with due regard to the power of old world countries such as Germany and Great Britain, both of whom were militarily superior to the United States. And in the East, the new and rather frightening phenomenon mm-hmm. of a crudescent Japan, crudescent at the same time that the Russian Empire was dangerously self-destructing. So it was a difficult world to handle, and it called upon all his diplomatic finesse.
And nothing like the superpower will go it alone possibilities that any president faces today. We're talking this hour with Edmund Morris, biographer of Theodore Roosevelt, author of the new book Theodore Rex. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What can we learn today from Teddy Roosevelt? What can George W. Bush learn from Teddy? Jack Beatty, when you look at these two presidents, with their very different profiles, but yet there are some parallels we can draw here and the table set before them. What jumps to mind?
Well, I'd like to emphasize the difference in context, historical mm-hmm. context mm-hmm. between them. H.G. Wells said of Roosevelt, and never did a president before so reflect the quality of his time. And that time was a time of extraordinary upheaval in society. The decade before had seen labor violence on a scale unimaginable to us today. The year 1888, there were 10,000 strikes in this country. Mm. There was the Pullman strike. There was the Homestead strike. There were the Haymarket riots. It went on and on. And in the midst of this, there was the worst depression the country had other than that of 1933, the depression of 1893. Mm. And Richard Hofstadter shrewdly observed that there were two sort of responses to this upheaval and discontent on the part of the public, and that they had two quite different moods. He says the motif of the first mood was social sympathy, mm-hmm. and of the second, national power. Well, T.R. embodied both those moods, the mood of social sympathy. He spoke feelingly of what he called the crushable elements at the bottom of our industrial civilization, mm-hmm. and through legislation from hours of work to the Food and Drug Act and so on, he tried to ameliorate the conditions of life of people there. But he also embodied the feeling about national power, so that he was extraordinarily in tune with the dominant sort of psyche of his day. Hofstadter calls him the master therapist of the middle class, because he was so in tune with both progressivism at home and what really was a kind of progressivism abroad, the view that the United States could bring a kind of moral beacon to the world. And he tried to project that even when he was doing things that were just up to his neck in realpolitik.
Edmund Morse, how about that? What do you think Teddy Roosevelt would have thought of the moral message emanating from the United States today?
Well, I know what I think of what Mr. Beattie just said. I thought that was brilliant, and I agree with every word. I rather wish I'd written in that
fashion. Take it down quick.
Could you send me a recording?
Sure. We promise. We will.
But you raised the question of morality. Yes, that's a large part of it. When T.R. left the White House, he said to one of his aides, I think my time has been primarily one of moral leadership. We tend to remember him as Mr. Policeman of the Western Hemisphere and the perpetrator of the Panama Canal and the muscular Christian. But we forget that he had this acute moral sense, which was not, I emphasize, a religious conscience. But he did feel that the White House was a place of moral leadership, and the president had to espouse and articulate the simple moral principles on which the Constitution is based. He was brilliant at that and relentless at it. And I think that was a large part of his enormous popularity with the American people, that he really did seem to articulate what we as a nation stand for.
Well, you've looked at presidents who have been active much more recently. What do you think has happened to that sense of the U.S. presidency as a vessel for moral leadership?
Well, it depends on the personality of the president and the times. I have a theory which suits me. I don't know how professional historians might react to it, but it seems to me from my observation that presidents do tend to reflect their times in an almost occult way.
Mm-hmm.
In the poisonous, self-doubting 1960s, when I emigrated to this country, mm-hmm. we produced a poisonous, self-doubting president, President Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And we then went on to an era of malaise under Jimmy Carter, when our national horizon seemed to shrink and we became introspective and embarrassed by our powers and self-conscious and negative about ourselves. And that was the kind of presidency that Carter reflected. Then, at the end of the 1970s, we developed this strong instinctive desire to feel good about ourselves again, and we precipitated Ronald Reagan, who almost overnight transformed the national mood and made the word patriotism honorable again and made positivity a large part of our outlook in the 1980s.
This is a great tour. Bring us on up to date.
Then we went into the cyberspatial 1990s, when suddenly national borders dissolved away in the Internet and everything became free-floating. And we produced the free-floating cyberspatial Bill Clinton, whose presidency was entirely a matter of how many hits he could score out there in this formless space. He embodied our amorality and our drifting self-interest in the 1990s to such an extent that at the end of that decade, we once again had a revulsion, much as we did at the end of the 1970s. And we precipitated the strong and simple President Bush, who may not have much intellectual complexity, but is speaking common language again and seeming to stick to the simple basic truth that we revere.
What a great tour of the waterfront. You've looked at Ronald Reagan and his conservatism. George Bush, W. Bush, talks about his compassionate conservatism. But when he cracks open your book and reads about the kind of conservative that Teddy Roosevelt was, which is a kind of combination of conservatism mixed with a very progressive reformist agenda, what will George W. Bush make of that? What's happened with conservatism, or what was going on with Teddy that hasn't been going on more recently in the conservative movement?
Well, we all of us, presidents and book reviewers alike, all find in books what we want to find in them. I think if President Bush studied Theodore Roosevelt very carefully in the course of my book or any other good book on TR, he would find his progressivism very much the opposite of what he personally believes. I think he from what I know of him, he is still a very corporate person. His friendships and his loyalties are with corporate America. He's not a shining star of the environmental movement, as far as I can see so far. And he's going to have to recognize that TR came into office as a young patrician, conservative president who very rapidly and very steadily, should I say, became more and more progressive, as Mr. Beattie was indicating just now, and left office an amazingly radical president with an agenda, an unfulfilled legislative agenda that some of which lasted through to the New Deal.
A powerful legacy. Jerry's on the line. Welcome, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to take issue with what was just said about the Clinton presidency being this sort of free-floating, amorphous cyber presidency, and the suggestion that the American populace rose up against this, against Clinton, and brought George Bush into power on this wave of popularity.
It was a close shave, wasn't it?
It was an extremely close shave, and to say that there's anything popular and revolutionary about George W. Bush, I think, is just really inventing history.
Well, Jerry, isn't that maybe the taking it to the other extreme? And there's something popular about him. He did get a lot of votes.
Did he get more than Al Gore?
Well, the Supreme Court says so, but in any case, he at least got half.
Okay, so fine. What's that have to do with this wave of enthusiasm that's projected here for getting rid of Clinton?
Let's put it to Edmund Morris. And Jerry, thanks for your call. Edmund Morris, you might have imagined that not everyone would agree with that depiction of Bill Clinton and the response. I guess it's not a huge wave. Did Teddy Roosevelt come in on a huge wave? How would it compare?
Well, the gentleman's absolutely right. George Bush did not come in on a wave of popularity. In fact, if the last election proved anything, it was that we really didn't want either of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the popularity is quite palpable now. I mean, because of his performance in the recent emergency, he has developed popularity and a support nationwide, which is really quite formidable. And I've got a feeling it's going to last a good long time.
And what kind of wave did TR come in when he finally did win his own election to the presidency?
There again, TR came in not particularly popular, but during the course of his first term, during which he behaved very cautiously, balancing conservatism on the one hand against the beginnings of progressivism on the other. After that first term and after his triumphant re-election, when his popularity really became manifest, that's when the true progressive revealed himself. And as I try to show in my book, in his second term, he became radical beyond the wildest dreams of those who'd been plotting his career beforehand.
We're talking tonight about Theodore Roosevelt, President Extraordinaire, with biographer Edmund Morris, looking back on the times of the Rough Rider when he got to the White House, how he handled that opportunity, the extraordinary background he brought to it, and the way he mixed conservatism and progressivism in a fashion that's really out of fashion. You can join the conversation. What can we learn from Teddy Roosevelt today? What do you wish that George W. Bush would learn from Teddy Roosevelt? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Edmund Morris, author of the new book, Theodore Rex Biography of Theodore Roosevelt During His Time in the Presidency, an extraordinary book from an extraordinary biographer who won the Pulitzer Prize for his first volume on Teddy Roosevelt. We're looking back at Teddy Roosevelt's time and character and trying to see what light it might shine on our circumstances and the presidency and president today. Edmund Morris, look at, for us, if you will, the relationship between Washington and big business when Teddy Roosevelt came to town and how he perceived and then changed that relationship.
Really rather similar to our own time. The American people were preoccupied with the phenomenon of business combination at the turn of the century. In those days, these great combinations, these monopolies were called trusts. Mm-hmm. Now we just call them monopolies. But the Microsoft of its time was the Northern Securities Company, a huge railroad combine that was formed just after TR became president. Mm-hmm. And he proceeded to prosecute this super trust so dramatically and so successfully that when the Supreme Court upheld him, conveniently in time for his own election campaign in 1904, he had succeeded in re-establishing the popular belief, the popular feeling that a government did have the power, when it came to the crunch, to discipline these giant corporations. Before he became president, you see, McKinley and his cabinet were corporate men, conservatives who believed in laissez-faire, mm-hmm. believed in free enterprise and the untrammeled growth of great corporations. TR felt that the antitrust laws had been allowed to go dormant and therefore decided to reinvigorate them by showing that they could still be applied, and that although he personally admired the efficiency of great corporations, he felt the moral principle that they should be regulated by government should be made clear. And that's exactly what he did in the Northern Securities case.
Was this a new idea in the American political scene, economic scene at that time?
It was a dormant idea. The antitrust laws had been made quite strong in the 1880s and 1890s, but they had been allowed to lapse, and they needed to be reinvigorated. You could say that antitrust was born under TR because he was the first president to actually establish an antitrust division within the Department of Justice, and we all know what's happened to that division ever since.
Mm. Jack Beattie, how about that? It's been a century. Where have we come on this front?
Well, you know, I was looking back at his autobiography, and he writes that in late 19th century America, he said it was swept by a, quote, riot of individualistic materialism. The power of the mighty industrial overlords had increased with giant strides, while the methods of controlling them or checking abuses by them on the part of the people through the government remained archaic and therefore practically impotent. I say no more in the wake of the Enron scandal than just to enunciate those words. His solution to it was not necessarily to break these companies up. That was really the position of Woodrow Wilson in 1912. His solution, as he puts it, was to he said that they were indispensable. The size of them was indispensable, but it was folly to prohibit that. But it was also folly to leave them, as he said, without thoroughgoing control. And that was quite an insight. In the 1912 campaign, Wilson replied, he said, well, if the government is going to tell businessmen how to run their business, then don't you see that big businessmen have to get closer to government even than they are now? Don't you see that they must capture the government in order to not to be restrained by it too much? Well, that's right out of John McCain. That is, of course,
sure
exactly
is,
what has happened.
It sounds like right off the McCain bus. Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello, fellas.
Good evening.
Good evening. My question, I guess, and my comment is that, you know, you folks are comparing Bush and what he might learn from Teddy Roosevelt, specifically, I suppose, conservation and social, the social safety net. And my comment would be when Teddy Roosevelt came to power, the snapshot of the country was much, much different. In other words, if Bush came to power at the time that Roosevelt did, I mean, he would be able to make monumental changes.
Well, surely over the century, things have changed a lot. But that's an interesting point you raised, Bob. Let's put it to Edmund Morris. Edmund Morris, you've studied presidencies. Do you agree that the opportunities for impact are vastly different at different moments in time, or are they always sitting there waiting for a president who wants to take the initiative to make change?
I think your second point is the correct one. I think that the great issues that presidents have to handle are the same. Essentially, that lonely Oval Office is a place where the man who inhabits has got to keep the nation secure and solvent. If he can do that, he's an effective president. Of course, times change. great powers rise up, science advances, society becomes more complex. But the main issues that the president has to handle, I do not think, change. He has to articulate what we believe about ourselves as a country. He has to stand for our security and our dignity. He has to keep us economically solvent. And he has to seem to embody the best in us. If he can do that, no matter whether his name be Abraham Lincoln or Ronald Reagan or Theodore Roosevelt, then he will be regarded kindly by history.
Of course, Theodore Roosevelt had such a vigorous presidency. When he came to the end of it, when he was leaving the White House, what had he learned? What were his thoughts about that office and its power, its responsibility?
He had become aware of the fact that that power corrupts. He never articulated this, but it's pretty plain reading between the lines of his private letters that he recognized in himself the effect of too much power exercised too strongly. In other words, when he was offered a third term in 1908, which he could have had on a silver platter, he was still only 48 years old and he loved being president and he longed to remain one, he, in a genuinely great gesture, denied himself a third term and went off into retirement at the extremely early age of 50.
Was this because of a public commitment to do so, or was it just a private belief that he should?
Oh, he had made a public commitment. That's quite true. After his election in 1904, he said, when I've served out this full term, I will regard that as two practically full terms, and I will follow the precedent of George Washington and not run for a third. However, he could have changed that decision at the flick of a pen whenever he wanted to in his second term. What I think is great about the decision is that he recognized that even a truly honest and patriotic American can be corrupted by power. He'd begun to make a few executive mistakes himself, largely arrogant ones, in particular the Brownsville episode of 1906, and therefore he gave away power at the moment when he most longed to keep it.
And Edmund Morse, in the 30 seconds we have left, do you think Teddy Roosevelt could have looked forward a century and imagine the scale of global power that the United States has come to today?
I don't know how far he could have looked ahead. It's a matter of record that he looked ahead at the rise of the Japanese Empire and saw that a threat was building up, a threat and a challenge to the United States on the other side of the Pacific Rim, and said that in the coming century, America must face toward the Far East, consider itself a Pacific power rather than its traditional orientation, looking back toward the old world.
But maybe a full century out was more than even Teddy Roosevelt could look, we imagine. Edmund Morse, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Edmund Morse is author of the new book, Theodore Rex, a biography of Theodore Roosevelt. His biography, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, won the Pulitzer Prize and the American Book Award. He also wrote the best-selling book about President Reagan, Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan. After 3 years serving as president following the assassination of William McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt was elected to the office in his own right in 1904. On March 4, 1905, he gave his inaugural address to the largest and most diverse audience in history, including cowboys and congressmen, soldiers, dignitaries, and coal miners. In his address, he spoke to a nation that was just joining the ranks of the world's great powers. Here's an excerpt of that address. It's read by former Senator George McGovern.
My fellow citizens, no people on earth have more cause to be thankful than ours, and this is said reverently, in no spirit of boastfulness in our own strength, but with gratitude to the giver of good, who has blessed us with the conditions which have enabled us to achieve so large a measure of well-being and of happiness. To us as a people, it has been granted to lay the foundations of our national life in a new continent. We are the heirs of the ages, and yet we have had to pay few of the penalties which in old countries are exacted by the dead hand of a bygone civilization. We have not been obliged to fight for our existence against any alien race. And yet our life has called for the vigor and effort without which the manlier and hardier virtues wither away. Under such conditions, It would be our own fault if we failed. And the success which we have had in the past, the success which we confidently believe the future will bring, should cause in us no feeling of vainglory, but rather a deep and abiding realization of all which life has offered us, a full acknowledgement of the responsibility which is ours, and a fixed determination to show that under a free government, a mighty people can thrive best, alike as regards the things of the body and the things of the soul. Much has been given us, and much will rightfully be expected from us. We have duties to others and duties to ourselves, and we can shirk neither. We have become a great nation, forced by the fact of its greatness into relations with the other nations of the earth, and we must behave as beseems a people with such responsibilities. Toward all other nations, large and small, our attitude must be one of cordial and sincere friendship. We must show not only in our words, but in our deeds, that we are earnestly desirous of securing their goodwill by acting toward them in a spirit of just and generous recognition of all their rights. But justice and generosity in a nation, as in an individual, count most when shown not by the weak, but by the strong. While ever careful to refrain from wrongdoing others, we must be no less insistent that we are not wronged ourselves. We wish peace, but we wish the peace of justice, the peace of righteousness. We wish it because we think it is right, and not because we are afraid. No weak nation that acts manfully and justly should ever have cause to fear us, and no strong power should ever be able to single us out as a subject for insolent aggression.
That was former Senator George McGovern reading an excerpt from the inaugural address of Theodore Roosevelt from March 4, 1905. You can listen to the whole speech at our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on special coverage. Jack Beatty, there's a president in the powerful adolescence of a nation bringing principle and morality and this notion of healthful justice to everything he says.
Yeah, and the perspective he takes there, you know, we're the heirs of the ages, he said, yet we have not yet had to pay the price attendant on our chosenhood, as it were. And, of course, that just rings so resonantly to us today. And then in a phrase that President Kennedy used, much has been given us and much is expected. This idea of decadence was sort of in the air then, and William James talked about it when he said that, you know, physical exercise was the moral equivalent of war, and it was very much thought that, you know, that this was one of the things he was doing with his foreign policy. He was letting, you know, the frontier had been closed in 1890, and the country was sort of claustrophobic for the first time. Mm-hmm. And here's this man who says, well, let's look abroad. Mm-hmm. And we go across the ocean and we get our empire in the Philippines and elsewhere, and we're launched on the path.
Let us be earnest, just, and generous.
Earnest, just, and generous. Hard to beat that trinity.
It's hard to beat, but we are no longer exempt from penalties of this old world, I guess, today.
No, and that haunts that speech that he just gave.
It does, in every word. Jack, Edmund Moore salutes you. I guess we all do tonight. Well done. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you.
The inimitable Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR, Boston.